Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I just want to read a little quote before we begin to just set the tone for today's conversation I'm about to have. I am truly blessed to have this conversation. I hope you guys feel the same when you start hearing. It is only when the oppressed find the oppressor out and become involved in the organized struggle for their liberation that they begin to believe in themselves. This discovery cannot be purely intellectual, but must involve action, nor can it be limited to mere activism, but must include serious reflection. Only then will it be praxis. Well, today I am joined with an icon, Jamal Joseph. This is his first book, Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. Good morning, Jamal. Thank you so much for coming to the show today.
Good morning, Joy. It's a real pleasure to be here.
That quote I just read is from The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Paulo Freire. And the reason I wrote that, because throughout your book, one of the things, you are always seeking knowledge, either of your mind, of your physical body, and near the end, your spirit, always seeking knowledge to enlighten yourself, but also combined with action. So I thought that quote was so powerful and relevant to your story.
Absolutely. It's knowledge and connection. One of the things we used to say in the Black Panther Party is that all theory is based on practice. So if you're learning some things, you know, political theory, social theory, grassroots organizing theory, this is good, but you have to put it into practice personally, or you have to get out there in the community and start serving people, working with people. Whatever it is, this is how we, the true end of knowledge for grassroots people is the practice of it and the sharing of it with other people.
Definitely, and you've been doing that almost all your life. I mean, you had a great foundation. I'm not sure, maybe you probably realized as you got older the foundation that you had. Initially, yes, you were given up. You were put into foster care by your mom. And so people, maybe when they first hear that, might think, oh, wow, you know, that's like the bad story, you know. But then you somehow were blessed with caretakers that really dropped a lot of knowledge on you at a young age and shared a lot of information, also gave you structure and discipline. And then got you in these programs. Talk about the Order of the Feather for a minute, and for people who are not familiar with that camp program.
They really did. My adoptive grandparents, took me in when they were quite old, and they're older brothers and sisters, and their parents had been slaves, so they knew about racism and slavery and lynching and Ku Klux Klan firsthand. They had friends and relatives who had been lynched, and yet they were activists. They were in Garvey's Back to Africa movement. They were the NAACP Youth Council. And they got me involved in a place called Minisink, which was the oldest African-American camp in New York State. And Minisink understood that we needed structure, that the young campers coming from Harlem and the Bronx and other black communities, that we needed structure. So within the camp, there were organizations, rites of passage organizations. One was called Tapawingo for young men and women, and the Order of the Feather is a rite of passage fraternity where you really had to keep your grades up, be really disciplined. There was physical exercise. You had to beat the big brothers, and then when you crossed over and became a featherman, you really felt like you had taken a real step toward manhood. You earned something, and for in the black community, where we have to fight twice as hard to get half as much, this is great, great training and positive bonding for young men. You know, a lot of young men will come out and they'll seek the love of the streets because there's some gang members that have a particular swagger and toughness, and that's talking to them when their parents are not talking to them, when their teachers weren't. And the Order of the Feather was founded for exactly that reason. There was a gang epidemic in Harlem in the 40s, and the men who were teachers and social workers and Boy Scout leaders came together and formed something that would be a strong and loving challenge for our young men.
Well, it's definitely needed even today. I think it's always needed. I myself grew up with, you know, revolutionary parents. My mom wouldn't let me have a relaxer in my hair until I was out of high school. You know, I had all these books in our household, you know, even though it wasn't like shoved down my throat, but it was always there. The places they took, the arts they took me to see, having that foundation can really kind of save your life in a sense. And I think that's what partly saved your life and that you're here today. Now, after all this foundation and everything, you decided you wanted to be a revolutionary. And, you know, you went into the Panzer office and you were, like, ready to fight somebody. But before the Panzer office, a hilarious story, half hilarious, half sad, in the beginning of the book, when you went south, that was a big tradition. A lot of black families sent their kids south or sent them to the, you know, suburbs of farm, get out. I went, I'm from Pennsylvania, I went out to Doylestown and it's almost like a godmother. She had like a couple acres of land, so I got connected with the land and stuff. That's a real important rite of passage for some black children in America. But you went south and you caused a ruckus. Talk to the audience about the ruckus you caused in the south at a young age.
Well, I went down south to a small town called Marshall, Virginia, where you know, where family was, some aunties and uncles, and it was still highly racist, if not segregated. You know, this is the early mid 1960s, and we were playing softball, and it was some of the black kids from one side of the street playing in this field with the white kids. And it was a bossy little white kid who was, you know, telling everybody what to do, and I didn't like his attitude and the way he just talked to everybody and bossed everybody around, especially my little cousins. And I was from New York City, so we ain't take mess, especially from little white kids trying to be tough. And I said, if he says one thing to me, and when I look back on it, what he said was not that bad, right? They were pitching me the softball, and, you know, they threw a strike, and they threw the softball, and they said another strike, and he said to me, hit the ball. Let's don't stand there like some bean pole. Well, that was enough. He might as well have talked about my mama. I hurled that bat down and went and, you know, wore him out. And, you know, for a moment I was a hero with the other little kids, especially with the black kids. Then we went across the street, and I think about a half hour, 45 minutes later, these pickup trucks came, all of these burly-looking white men. And they talked to my auntie, who was like my grand-aunt. She was also old enough to be a grandma, and the women in the house. And they came back, and they said, boy, pack your bags, you're going to New York City. The little boy that I punched turned out to be the Grand Dragon son of the Ku Klux Klan. So that was the end of my little southern summer vacation. Keep in mind, though, this was what was fresh in the consciousness of black people in the South and all over the country was the murder of Emmett Till. Even though that murder had happened a few years earlier, I remember my grandmother kept copies of that Jet magazine and the Ebony magazine, where Emmett's body, his bloated body, had been on display and talked about what happened to him for whistling at a white woman. So that kind of consciousness of what could happen and what could happen to a little black boy was fresh in their mind. And so they really, in their mind, and probably in reality, were protecting me, you know, saving my life by getting me back up to New York where I could, you know, do that kind of mess.
Exactly. And so after that incident, you still weren't scared. And you still decided you wanted to become a revolutionary, and because you saw the power and the strength of the Black Panthers in the street standing up to the police officers, you decided you wanted to continue with this, I would say, high-risk behavior, in a sense, getting involved in a whole bunch of mess, as they would say, but for a good purpose. One of the things I wanted to highlight, a lot of times people think about the Black Panthers, and they have the guns, and they're standing in formation, but people may not realize that they want to power and freedom for all people. You know, some people, they think, oh, it's only about black people. When they say black people, oh, that's all about black people. But they want the power for white people, for Native Americans, for Latino people. Talk to me about your first impression of the Black Panthers, that experience a little bit.
Well, you know, this was a time when as a generation, younger black people were starting to question our parents in the form of the Civil Rights Movement, because there was a certain amount of anger and indignation that was manifesting itself among new leadership that was emerging, people like Stokely Carmichael and H.R.F. Brown, and Stokely Carmichael saying, you know, black power, you know, coining the phrase black power. And I remember seeing H.R.F. Brown, not fully understanding who he was, but that word black militant. Rapp had gotten arrested for possessing a rifle in Louisiana, and he came out on bail, and he was having a press conference in front of the courthouse steps, and told the reporters, if you thought my rifle was bad, wait till you see my atom bomb. And I went, wow, he's bad. that ties into the whole manhood thing in the black community, you know, the dozens and not backing down.
Mm-hmm.
So that same, you know, seeking the path for manhood. And although I had this good mentorship, you know, in the Order of the Feather, my grandfather had died a few years earlier. I never knew my dad. So you're constantly seeking that. And we equate manhood with badness, with toughness. When Dr. King was killed, that just kind of pushed it for me and a lot of young black people who were trying to be respectful. You know, I was in the NAACP Youth Council and trying to see if these tactics and nonviolence would work. But white America killed Dr. King. And I got mad, went down, participated on the fringes of the riot on 125th Street, and got together with some friends and, you know, who had found a secret location, we thought it was secret, of the Black Panther Party. And we took a ride out there, and not knowing what it really was, we began to conjecture what it was to be a Panther, that we had to be tough, that we would never be allowed to leave, that we might have to kill a white dude to prove ourselves. So we walk into the office with all of this information that we made up, you know, about what it was to be a Panther. And as the meeting was progressing and the person up front was explaining the Panther 10-point program, which said nothing about hating white people, but what talked about, you know, decent housing and employment and education, I jumped up and I said, give me a gun and I'll kill a white dude right now. Well, the meeting stops. They call me to the front of the room. Brother reaches down into the desk drawer. My heart is pounding because I think he's going to give me like a big gun with a Panther logo on it. And he hands me a stack of books. The autobiography of Malcolm X, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver, Wretched at Earth by Fanon. And I thought this was a test. And I said, brother, I thought you were going to arm me. And he said, young brother, I just did. And then he said, if all of the problems in the community were flipped, so if all of the cops, the racist cops were black and the people being beaten up and murdered were white, and the store owners who were ripping off the community, if they were white, if they were black, the people being ripped off were white, and all of these politicians who are in power, the racist politicians, if all of them were black and the people being exploited and oppressed were white, would that make things correct? And I said, no, it seems like it would still be wrong, brother. He said, that's right. This is a class struggle for human rights. Study those books so you know what revolution is really about.
Definitely.
So that's the Panthers talked about class struggle. The slogan was all power to all of the people. And then the very next thing I got, Joy, still didn't get my gun. I got a pancake spatula. The next day I was able to report for duty. I got a pancake spatula and was learning how to make pancakes and serving kids in the Panthers free breakfast program. So 95% of your time in the Black Panther Party, you were not holding a gun. You were holding newspapers, you were holding books, you were holding children, you were holding elderly folks as you helped them get home at night safely. That's what your work. It was service. And there was this quotation that was in the Panther office that first day from Che Guevara on a poster that said, at the risk of sounding ridiculous, let me say that revolutionaries are guided by great feelings of love.
That is a foreshadowing of your evolution near the end of the book and in your life hasn't ended, so you're still evolving, about your focus on love. I do want to read from your book. This is related to the political prison system and legal system that people of color get entwined in unfairly. The typical relationship between a poor person on trial and his attorney is that of the common versus the elite. The lawyer is a sorcerer who understands the wizardry that is the law. The defendant is the commoner, unfortunate enough to be in the clutches of the empire, but lucky to have a sorcerer willing to donate a bit of precious time to his case. No need for the commoner to ask questions about the process, but it's too complex, because it's too complex for him to understand. And how dare the commoner question the strategy or the actions of the wizard? If the commoner had a grasp of how the law works, he wouldn't be in this miserable situation to begin with. I wanted to read that because prison and people of color is a big issue I had Michelle Alexander on talking about the new Jim Crow. I also had Khalil Gibran Muhammad on talking about the condemnation of blackness. This idea that black people are automatically bad or automatically subversive or automatically doing something negative to destroy, you know, I don't know, the powers that be for evil you know, purposes.
Yes, I mean,
how can we transform that today?
Yeah, you know, our relationship to the system has always been an economic relationship, and racism has been the marketing strategy and the ideology of how they would treat us. Slavery was a business, and we built this country and made many, many companies. I mean, we're not just talking about crops and farmland, but the first stock traded on Wall Street were African slaves, and the first insurance companies made their millions from insuring, you know, the passage of those slaves, you know, Lloyd's of London and all of those companies. And then that went from being cheap labor and the Industrial Reserve Army, and now that relationship is that, you know, with technology, that we on the streets have outlived our usefulness, but in prisons can still help the military-industrial complex flourish, because that you have there's you can't do slave labor or you know, below minimum wage while people are on the street, but certainly in prisons you can do it. And for a lot of states and for the federal government, the only branch of the bureaucracy of the machine that's making money are prisons, because they're manufacturing furniture and fiber optic cables and uniforms for the military and all of that. And so what you have to do in order to sell that to other good people, I mean, in slavery there were, you know, good white people that wondered if it was a sin to hold a slave, and the marketing strategy for the slave market is to say it's a sin to enslave another human being, but these Africans are not human, and that began racism as we know it today. So you continue to demonize the people so that you can do what you want to them, and then you continue to demonize the people, make it part of their own thinking, so that we begin to do things to one another so that we're afraid to break the cycle. When I was in prison, I spent 9.5 years in prison. I was arrested at 16 in the Panther 21 case. Every prison that I had been in over the course, I was out on bail and then went back and then out for a little while and then spent close to 6 years in federal prisons. And no matter where I was in the country, the majority of prisoners were black and brown men.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not the majority of the population, but we're the majority of the poor folks that the system wants to do away with. So that demonization that we're evil and that automatic, these statistics that say that 1 in 3 black boys are destined to wind up in the criminal justice system, but only 1 in 4, you know, will wind up in college, is alarming, it's startling, and it's something that we have to attack on a lot of levels. Yes, the protest and awareness of it, but this aggressive mentorship of young men so that they are deconditioned to believe that that's their destiny. There's a group of kids in Harlem that used to call themselves 25 to life. These young brothers would call themselves that because they believe that they were destined to be killed or to do life or be doing life in prison before they were 25. That's what they were saying. It wasn't a street gang called Hampton or Yale. You know what I mean? Because they believed they were determined to wind up in a historically black college or university or an Ivy League. You know, there wasn't something called service in education, because they believed that they were destined to give service or to be an educator. So we've got to reprogram that thinking by direct contact, mentorship, not just writing a check to something, not just showing up for an awards event, but really embracing our young people. And we had that in a community where grandmothers with no training, no training in education or sociology, would look out for every boy on that block, every girl on that block. That was her grandkid. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So she knew when you wasn't in school. She knew when you hadn't eaten dinner, you had to come eat. She knew when it was time for your
curfew. She found out about me smoking. Jamal, she found out about me smoking. I was smoking in between two cars in front of my house, and one of the neighbors told my mom. I thought I was being cool, like, oh, sneak, and boom, I got caught. My mom didn't even say anything to me until I got sick from smoking. And she's like, I already knew about it because someone still told me. But I just wanted to see if you was going to come tell me.
That's right. My smoking story was I got a grandmother in the neighborhood that spanked me, and I'm in front of my boys. And the only thing I could bring, and she said, I'm going to tell your parents. And the only thing I could bring myself to say was that, you know, you know, when they went away, you know, I didn't think about disrespecting her, talking back to her, even when she was gone. The only thing I could say, well, she could do what she wanted to do because my grandma ain't got no phone. That's the best comeback I could have. And, Joy, when I came home, grandma was waiting because I'm going to tell you, she didn't have a telephone line and there was no internet, but there was grandma net.
I love it. Yes.
And I caught it. I caught it coming in, and I understood even when I was catching it that this was love,
Well, I want to focus on that mentorship word because I want to bring in, we're going to have to skip a huge chunk, but everybody, I'll be giving away a copy of your book, Panther Baby, so follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys, become a fan on Facebook. Also, follow J Panther Baby on Twitter. That's Jamal Joseph's hook on Twitter. But I want to focus on this mentorship. You had a huge transformation because you realized about some internal stuff you hadn't been facing, that you had been, hitting a wall purposely. And you hit the wall but somehow got in contact with the arts. Tell us about that first experience and how the arts transformed you and your view of people from different gangs. I'll just put it that way.
Two great quotes in my life. One was Malcolm X saying, "Penitentiary has been the university for many a black man." And the other was from an old convict when I got to Leavenworth, Mr. Cody, who said, "You can let this time serve you. You can serve this here time, young blood, or you can let this time serve you." And I took that to be a daily mantra of what one could do. So I enrolled in college. I earned 2 degrees from the University of Kansas. They had an amazing program where they came in and you worked hard. The professors worked you really hard, and you earned a degree and come out. Sadly, that's been cut, as liberal politicians want to show that they're tough someplace. Where do you get tough? You get tough on crime, which means you're getting tough on poor folks. And then I had done some theater through the Black Arts Movement while I was in the Panthers. And brothers found out about it and told me, assigned me the task of doing a play for Black History Month. I wrote a play, we're rehearsing, and, you know, as prisons are segregated because men segregate themselves, and the tough gangs take over sections of the yard and nobody leaves their section. We're rehearsing for this play, and some Latino brothers who are, came from their section of the yard, tough guys, a couple of these guys had been convicted of, like, assaults and murders since they had been in prison and got their sentences in the street. And they're coming, they're watching this rehearsal. You know, we're in this little area above the gym. We're thinking they left their courtyard, their section, to come here. Who are they here to kill? And one of the brothers is really, he's the leader of the gang, and he's zeroing in on me as I'm working with a couple of the brothers who hadn't acted before. And after about 10 minutes, he calls me over. He says, "Yo, man, let me speak to you a minute." He says, "I've been here for about 10 minutes because I heard what you were doing. I came to check it out, Holmes. And I'm going to tell you something right now. That guy you're working with, that guy, that effing guy, yo, Holmes, he's not feeling his character."
I started cracking up on it. I was
true story. So I said, "Why don't you get involved?" And he was great. I rewrote the play so that it was a black and Latino play. You know, now we're away from Black History Month, right? One of the guys who was the leaders of the white prisoners, and they were a mixture of guys who were bikers and white supremacists, he comes, and then he comes back down to his guys, and they thought that he went up just to knock somebody out because he was, 6'3" and 240 pounds of muscle and a black belt, and he comes back, and his guys surround him. They said, "Reb, we heard you went up there with the blacks and the Mexicans." He said, "Yep." They said, "Well, Reb, what are they up to?" And he said, "A play." They said, "Well, Reb, what'd you do about it?" He said, "Well, they give me a part." So we have the only multicultural. We had our own courtyard now of guys who were heavy hitters, of guys who hadn't thought about doing anything together, working together, let alone something creative, that found their human connection through the work, that started writing, that started acting. Some guys started playing, music for the shows. And I became aware at that moment the power of the creative arts and transformation, and that maybe arts and activism could come together, and then I, through education and the arts, could be an artivist, an art and an activist who used the arts for social change.
Well, I mentioned to you earlier before we started how the arts has changed my life. I went to a performing arts elementary school, and just real quick, recently my old dance teacher passed away, and I'm 47 years old, so I won't say the whole number, but I'm 24. but anyway, so I remembered her, and that's how much of an impact this woman had on my life, because not only did she teach me dance, she taught me discipline, and she taught me self-esteem in myself, to be proud of myself when I stood on stage, to stand tall, to walk tall, to speak, you know, properly. I had elocution, I had visual arts, I had music, so I learned how to play the flute. All these things, yes, maybe in some areas I had talent, but they also brought other things to my life, a sense of confidence, because I had similar issues you did, light skin. I was a bit of a geek. I was, you know, in the gifted program, you know, so I had to, like, defend myself. One day I flipped out on the, you know, on the courtyard with the kids, but the arts kept me, wow, throughout my entire life, and I think it's so important. In the chat room, I just want to let you know a lot of people are fans of yours, of what you're doing, your work and your book. They are just praising you. One question somebody asked about, what do you think about capitalism versus socialism and Marxism in this society today? Somebody asked that in the chat room.
I mean, it's a great question, and at a time when people really challenge that, that's when they get attacked the most by the government. When Dr. King started organizing, remember Dr. King was in Memphis organizing black and white sanitation workers in Chicago, and
mm-hmm.
he had denounced the war in Vietnam, not just as an unjust war, but a war of capitalist exploitation. State violence, the state, killed him within a year. Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam. There's a brilliant speech that he gave at Oxford University about 2 months before he died, where he talks about capitalism specifically, and he talks about people coming together and this notion of class struggle, this notion of the haves and the have-nots, and people struggling together. And Brother Malcolm was dead within a few months, within a year of, you know, starting to talk about that. When the Black Panther Party introduced this idea that slavery was a business and that the business of capitalism is to exploit and to oppress people, this is an idea that's very, very true. There's no middle class. You know, people who used to believe that if you had a job that you could get a second job and that would be your second home and your retirement money, now you need two jobs to pay half your bills, and everyone is just a couple of paychecks away from being homeless and living in
a couple,
maybe one paycheck.
You know?
And yet we're seeing these record profits. You know, the record, it's not like we're seeing the famine like, you know, like back in the day and the whole kingdom was suffering, you know, and everybody is going bad.
Great disparity.
So that something is wrong with that picture. And when you deal with the leadership, and if you deal with the president that is driving, you know, we used to say in the Panther Party, look, you could have the most humane, kind person, who's an engineer, you know, that's driving, you know, a locomotive. If that locomotive is headed off the tracks, the only thing they can do is maybe stop it, or it's going to go off the tracks, but you can't change course. The locomotive is damaged and the tracks are headed for destruction. And we're dealing with broken government based upon the idea. They won't let go of the idea that it's really okay. That it's really okay for a group of people, if they're smart enough and tough enough, to consume everything on the planet, to use every resource, to amass every dollar while people are starving.
Drain everything dry.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah. I think we have to have this conversation and this consciousness about redistribution of humanity. You know, if you don't want to say redistribution of wealth, because that scares people, because that sounds, you know, that sounds like socialism or this thing that we've been taught that's such an evil notion. By the way, put children in a room together. When they're little, they share. You know, it's human nature to share. It's human nature to look out. By the way, put children in a room together, black, white, brown, yellow children, they play together. It's human nature to interact. So let's talk about a redistribution of humanity. If we're afraid of something that says redistribution of the wealth, but understand that something has got to change, and that only comes from an outpouring and the cries of the people, like the Occupy movements, like the consciousness that's coming up on college campuses, like the consciousness that's coming up against mass incarceration, like the millions of, like the thousands of people that took to the streets of New York City, where I'm from, to say, what's with this stop and frisk? 700,000 black boys, you know, frisked just last year.
Right.
What's with that?
Right.
That's what it takes to make a change.
Questioning, constantly questioning, but constantly educating yourself. As I open the show with the pedagogy of the oppressed.
That's right. As Frederick Douglass said, agitate.
Angela Davis did a great book about Frederick Douglass. But we only have a minute left. I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I want to encourage everybody to check out the book, Panther Baby, so you can find out actually where that phrase Panther Baby came from. You'll get a little smile when you find out. But I'll be giving away copies. Follow me at Joy Keys. Become a fan on Facebook. And follow J. Panther Baby. And check out his, also his theater group, New Heritage Theater Group.
Impact Repertory Theater, using the arts and activism to transform lives. And the Order of the Feather, by the way, still exists, that rite of passage model. So we need those organizations for our young people.
Definitely. Thank you so much. And please come back again whenever you're doing work with your theater, your film. Also, he did Sonia Sanchez documentary. Sonia was on here recently. She just became Poet Laureate for Philadelphia. So that was a great film also that you worked on. And
she's
you've been nominated
truly,
for
truly
Oscar.
The hero. And Joy, I'll be in Philadelphia February 21st at the Philadelphia Free Library.
Oh, yes. I'll be there. I'll see you. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. You can follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. You can become a fan on Facebook. Also, check out Jamal Joseph on Twitter, J Panther Baby. Check out his website. He has a couple because he's doing so many different things he's doing these days. He's a professor. He's an Oscar nominee. His website, JamalJoseph.com. Also, check out his theater page, NewHeritageTheater.org, doing wonderful things with the community. He had been nominated for Oscar because of his work with young people and music and the arts, and they were actually in the movie August Rush singing the song Raise It Up, the chorus, with some kids that he worked with. So if you're out there, the kids are the focus. Continue to support young people. If you are complaining about what's going on in America today and you are not helping a young person or educating a young person or supporting a young person or supporting an organization that supports young people because they are the future, I don't have anything to say to you. That's all I've got to say today. If you're not mentoring, supporting mentorship, helping young people, or helping even just helping people, period, okay, go to help some senior center, paint somebody's nails, give some food, you know, help somebody move their furniture, they can't do it, you know, buy somebody a cup of coffee. That's what it's about, love. All right, peace. Stay tuned at 1 o'clock. I'll be speaking with author Rebecca Walker. Caller number for the show is 646-929-0368. You have a wonderful Saturday. Thank you so much for your support.